Hello and welcome to The Lip, the Leadership and Insurance podcast. Today we've got a brilliant episode. We'll be joined by Amit Patel of the InsurTech startup Healthy. Healthy is something that operates in the private healthcare insurance space. It's an interesting marketplace concept, and Amit is absolutely the perfect person to launch it. I was very lucky enough to meet him at Instech London when we were able to meet face-to-face, and just got on well when we followed up. He's a good guy, and he was very kind enough to talk me through his idea and his journey. It's a fascinating journey. This guy qualifies as a medic, becomes a surgeon, then decides to leave that behind to go into management consultancy, hugely successful career in private healthcare, and then abandons all that safety and security to be an entrepreneur. But we learn about him that he's been an entrepreneur for a very long time, and it's something that's in his bones, I think. So great guy, really good journey, and really interesting chat. So I hope you enjoy the show. Morning and welcome to the LIP podcast, the Leadership and Insurance podcast. I'm very fortunate today to be joined by someone well known to me, Amit Patel, who is the leader and founder of Healthy, a insurtech in the health space, as you would imagine. He's had a really interesting career. I'm lucky enough to have come across him at Instech London when we were allowed to kind of meet face to face and see people in the flesh and that sorts of thing. And I followed up with him and he was kind enough to give me some time. So he's got a great story and we're going to get into some things about insurtechs and startups. But first thing to do is say welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks very much, Alex. Delighted to join you.
Good. Thanks for coming in. I mean, obviously, I know your journey sort of somewhat, but you've had a sort of really interesting journey into. So I wondered if you could kind of walk people through your sort of career and how you've ended up in the insurance space.
Yeah, sure. I've got quite a checkered past, actually, and I'm very privileged to have done all the different things that I managed to do. So I guess I started off life as a medic. I went to Bristol University, read medicine. I did 2 degrees, obviously a medical degree and an integrated BSc in molecular and cellular pathology, which was very hot then and is still hot now. I got bored as an undergrad waiting around for clinics to happen. So I started reading the newspaper and doing grown-up things. And in that, I got quite excited to kind of basically enter some business plan competitions. And I entered the Times KPMG Business Award in 2000 and won it, where I had to write a kind of a business plan for how a charity would spend £5,000 to meet one of its objectives. So I picked a charity called Cancer and Leukemia in Childhood, CLICK. We used to basically get our clothes off on stage for this charity as medical students. And interestingly, they had a huge number of people in the Southwest. They supported children with cancer, but they were often remote to the hospital. So Bristol was a cancer center. And effectively, I devised a telemedicine solution and wrote a plan for that to be deployed to help these families and their children with cancer basically talk to the tertiary hospitals in the area. So that was the start of, like, you know, writing more and more business plan competitions, getting involved in loads more business plan competitions. And I eventually basically started up not a company, but a kind of a smart card based electronic medical record prototype. So we developed this and then managed to exit it. So I had quite an interesting undergrad kind of time, apart from my medical things, I did a lot of commercial stuff. And then I finished and basically did my junior doctor year, lectured at Oxford University, became a member of the Royal College of Surgeons. And I was sort of 5 years into my medical practice and was training as a breast and endocrine surgeon when it hit me that, you know, one, I wanted to do something more commercial, but two, the NHS is incredibly inefficient. And because I was someone who wanted to make things more efficient and, you know, enable things with technology, it was just becoming more and more frustrating for me as one person to kind of constantly have that battle with the institution. And also careers around medicine were changing. Mm-hmm. You know, the juniors that were coming through were working half the number of hours that we were. And so they were less experienced in theatre. And, you know, I found myself and I saw colleagues older than me who were further in their career sort of having to spend a lot more time in theatre out of hours, but not like going to get any additional benefit or reward for it. Mm. So anyway, I decided to, you know, jump ship. I was either going to go into pharma consulting or do an MBA. And I kind of parallel tracked all of those things and found my way to go and work for a company called LEK, which is a strategy and M&A consulting firm, which was really good fun. I spent 5 years there, had a fast track promotion, and basically did strategy and M&A transaction support for Fortune 500 companies across life sciences, healthcare, financial services. And that was good fun and very hard work and a very different mode of working, obviously not operating and seeing patients and stuff.
What was that like? I was going to say, what was that like sort of culturally? And I've got to ask, because it's like the sort of medicine route. You know, it's well known that medicine is not an easy thing to kind of achieve in terms of getting through the level of education, the application. So I understand the sort of frustration element, but what was that like? What was your friends and family's reaction to you saying, well, I want to leave medicine? That's what I was saying. That's all
I know. So I don't come from a traditional Asian family, I don't think. So my parents were never proponents of me doing, you know, the stereotypical things that Asian parents want you to do. So, you know, law, medicine, that kind of stuff. So I think they were kind of surprised and quietly happy that I was doing medicine. My dad saw the kind of entrepreneurial side of me early on, and he was quite keen to push me into like finance and, you know, just be a bit more attuned to what you like to do. So when I put it to them that I was thinking about leaving, they were surprised. And my mum was like, you know, are you really sure that this is what you want to do? I mean, colleagues and friends within, you know, from my medical sphere were all like, you're pretty crazy. And I did this, 13, 14 years ago now. So, you know, I was kind of a pathfinder. I think I only knew one or two other people that had done it. And most of them, or at least I think one of them that had done it, had gone straight from university out of their medical undergraduate year into consulting. So they hadn't worked for like 5 years in the NHS before jumping ship. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure about whether I was making the right decision. And also because I ended up going to LEK Consulting, they never had like McKinsey and other consulting firms, just a kind of a postgraduate or higher experienced hire program. So I actually went in as if I was coming out of university. So I, you know, more than half my salary, you know, started with people who've never worked before, typically. So, you know, I had to totally retrain, you know, and I was sitting in the office with, you know, with a peer group that was about 5 or 6 years. In fact, some of them were 9 years my junior, right, in terms of age. So, yeah, it was a very interesting time. But I guess I'm one that I like to mix things up, and I tend to embrace change and take risk, I guess, overall.
Because I wanted to touch on that a little bit. And the reason why is because, you know, I mentioned to this just before we started recording that I speak to a lot of people that want to sort of shift out of insurance, maybe into the insurtech space. And the harsh reality I have to push back is to say, you know, what do you offer? And if, yeah, sure, if someone's going to turn around and be a full stack digital insurer, you know, you need good insurance people within it. But if you're challenging the insurance model, it doesn't necessarily have room for a traditional skill set. And one of the things is probably being prepared to do what you did at that stage, which is you might have to go in at a much more junior level. You might have to, you're treated as if you've got not a lot of experience because you in that field, you haven't, but it seems like that's something that you're prepared to do.
Yeah. I mean, it was then, and it was a lot easier because I was 29.
Yeah.
I'm 42 now, married. I have 3 children at private school, a mortgage, and all of the grown up things that everyone has.
Yeah.
And it was much harder this time round to kind of take a jump. You know, the financial security of a job at Bupa, which is where I was most recently, versus now, you know, it's totally different. So you get all the stuff around autonomy, no one telling you what to do, you doing what you think is right for, you know, an industry that hasn't really changed and has been a laggard, in my view, from a digital transformation perspective for some time. Mm-hmm. But you have all the whims and woes and the worries around how long is it going to take to launch? How much runway have I got to fund this? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously nervous partners, my wife, who's kind of like, you know, what are you doing? And are you really wanting to like take a major risk like this right now in your life when we've got all of these other things to think about? Mm. So it's tougher as you get older, but then I guess you're wiser, more experienced, etc. And I've had very many vantage points around health and insurance, right? So I've actually delivered care firsthand into the NHS through strategy and M&A and some of my work at Bupa. You know, we've run businesses, bought them, sold them, turned them around. All operating in either insurance or some form of healthcare provision. Mm. And then more recently built ventures and launched them at Bupa. Got heavily involved in and cut my teeth on products and technology, which I never really had that kind of angle to my career. So if anyone's equipped to do this, it should be me, given, you know, the experience that I've had going through. So, and by the way, that's just helping me boost my own self-confidence around making a dicey decision to go into startup land. But, you know, I feel more confident than I would have done before to do this now.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And so let's go back. Sorry, I interrupted you before. You were elect consulting, management consulting for 5 years, doing M&A activity. And then you found yourself working at Bupa, is that right? Is that the next one?
So I kind of got married, we had our first daughter, and I felt I shouldn't be working 16 hours a day or more often, and probably should get a better work-life balance. That was one thing. And the other thing was you know, giving strategic recommendations is one thing, but you know, it sort of 80% of the outcome is related to execution. And being a medic and, you know, being a surgeon, I feel like I'm a natural operator. And so I wanted to go and do some of this in line so that I didn't just provide the recommendation, but also went on to do some execution. Mm-hmm. So at Bupa, although I've done a number of roles, I mean, the key roles I've done, group head of new business development is what I joined as. And that was really looking at opportunities around healthcare provision and digital health around the world for Bupa. Because Bupa was reorganized as I was coming in, that the core execution role around strategy and M&A went into markets. So I came into the UK market strategy and M&A director, and obviously did the usual corporate and business unit strategy, but I got heavily involved in divesting Bupa Home Healthcare, which I went in and sat in with management and turned quite a large business, which was losing money, around into profit, split it into two, and then divested both elements of it successfully and taking it through European competition clearance. So that was kind of getting deep into execution and kind of selling a business and transforming it. And then the last 3 or so years at Bupa, I was director of New Ventures, which was an entrepreneurial unit which looked to build new digital propositions and businesses and launch them into market. And I worked on a number of initiatives, but one of them was Bupa On Demand, which we launched and scaled, which is basically a private healthcare pay-as-you-go marketplace. But also I got heavily involved in digital transformation around customer journey, particularly for our insurance customers, and worked with a company that Bupa had invested quite a significant amount of money in, called HealthTap, which was a Silicon Valley startup. So I designed and built products on their platform for insurance customers, effectively to improve the way they're serviced.
So quite that was a global remit as well then. So sort of always had a sort of global outlook on these markets.
Yeah, Ventures was a UK remit, but connected with what used to be the customer lab and the various other innovation structures that existed within Bupa. Mm-hmm. So we're constantly asked to appraise things that were global and UK-based. The work with HealthTap was global. It was across three markets, kind of Spain, Australia, and the UK. So, yeah. But, yeah, fairly global outlook.
Yeah. So how did you find that operating in that sort of quite an advanced tech space on tech platforms, but coming from a non-tech background? And what are the sort of challenges you face while you're trying to kind of lead those sorts of teams?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a technophobe, to say the least. I love technology. I had my first PC when I was 9 years old, which was in 1989. And my parents spent £1,800 to buy it, which was a lot of money for them then.
So I
would say, like, I love technology, and I'm like your master user of technology, if you like. And so from the perspective of, like, taking a user's view, I think I bring that, you know, in healthcare and how patients should move through a system, etc. I wasn't, and I'm not a technology expert, but I've acquired a lot of knowledge because I'm hungry for information all the time. I like learning. So, you know, understanding what cloud native infrastructure is, microservices are, Kubernetes are, front end, back end, you know, React Native, all that, all the jargon. I love all of that, and understanding, you know, how you take kind of an idea of a product, understand how you wireframe and build a set of designs, user test them, and then translate those into a front end and back end technology stack that's got enough flexibility to scale, to change the experience, and to start to leverage data. Because again, my heritage, at least from consulting, has been around data. I mean, Elica was always a data-led consultancy firm, highly analytical. So how you can use that data from these systems to kind of better improve your business and the customer experience and scale, I think has been some of the key things that have been through, you know, whether it's divesting and turning around a company to thinking about growth in a new digital venture. It's just been there throughout. So I think it's been hard work, like getting up to speed. But again, you know, just I love that sort of stuff and kind of diversifying what I'm doing into something that's different and that I don't know. Working with tech teams, that can be challenging. Time zones, distributed teams, I think that's a big problem as it is, because when I was working at Bupa, we were working with teams, you know, from San Fran all the way through to Australia, which made it really tough from an operational point of view. But, you know, again, generally, design and technology teams are not domain experts in insurance, or historically, at least in my interactions, have not been experts in health or kind of insurance. And so, you know, sort of getting them to understand the fuller picture around what you're trying to achieve and the role that they play and the dependencies and how fast you need to go, that is a key challenge around how you work with people in, you know, product, frankly, design products and technology. If they've got experience in domain experience, then that's different. I think that helps a lot. But then, as you say, you almost need a fresh pair of eyes and have the expertise around design technology grounded in your team rather than the experience around domain, which can come from other people within the team.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a bit, it's been a very hot topic lately, is, you know, almost everything I work on in the insurance space, if they're looking for technology, they're saying they must have insurance technology experience. And I understand it from a hit the ground running perspective. And I imagine it's advantageous. But then there's the argument that a tech stack is a tech stack, and if you understand the tech, then you're the right person. And obviously, if you're coming from another sector, sometimes you can add value and look at things in a slightly different way, which is a lot of the guiding principle behind a lot of the insurtech ecosystem anyway, is fresh eyes on a 300-year-old industry. So but I think it depends on time, and, you know, if you've got if you're running a lean team, if you're running a startup, sometimes time is the important thing. So it can be advantageous to have that experience already.
You need people who can get stuff done. When you have a lean team, you'll be very lucky to have people who've got all the domain expertise plus their core functional expertise within it. We're lucky enough to have a CTO who is a domain expert and is a technologist, but that's not always the case. And there are obviously challenges with that, like you say, because really what you want is someone who's an expert in technology and is at the bleeding edge of all the new cutting technology that's coming out that can basically help you build a platform that is, if you can say it anymore, future-proof, but I don't think that's even a word.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. What does that even mean these days? Yeah. Let's get back just to, so you're up at Bupa, the family's happy, everyone's secure, they're all comfortable. So what was the kind of, what's the genesis of the idea? Please explain to everyone listening about Healthy and what it is, and kind of, you know, what made this idea? Because there must have been plenty before it, the one that you wanted to go and get behind.
Yeah, I looked at a whole load of ideas, really it was through my experience at Bupa and previously when I was working in the NHS, I just found that the kind of insurance model of today just doesn't work, and really it's for three reasons. One, it's really expensive, right? For an individual to purchase a policy in the market in 2017, it was approximately, you know, on a market basis or blended basis, it was about £117 per calendar month, which is too much for most people, right? Let's face it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think the entire notion of health insurance is complicated. You know, what are you covered for? What aren't you covered for? Mm-hmm. 63 pages of T's and C's. I don't think that's really palatable for a consumer these days. And you almost need a PhD to decode what everything means, right? So that's the second problem. And I think the third problem is the whole thing's analog, right? Yeah. And I mean this in the kind of nicest way, but really, you know, this insurance company is not built on a kind of cloud native architecture with a proper data model sitting underneath it, with, you know, real time data availability and a stellar customer experience with an app or a website or web app or whatever. You know, customer services, insurance operations, and even care delivery these days, until sort of COVID, has largely been face-to-face analog, right? And so this is intertwined with, you know, how complicated your product is. It's also intertwined with expense because everything analog and manual costs money. In the long run is less efficient, and therefore that, you know, that is passed on back to the consumer via price, hence making the product more expensive. So those were the real reasons, and I thought I could give it a good bash, right? There's only really four main players in the market, as you know, Bupa, AXA, Aviva, Vitality, and having looked at their propositions and what they offer, price points and how they operate, surely there's a better way of doing this, right? Which and even distribute, frankly. So that was kind of the crux of the idea and the will to do it, and almost self belief around the fact that because I'd wandered in my career where I had, that maybe I've got half the chance to do it in terms of know-how, capability, and network, right? Mm-hmm. People that I know around me that could help me along the way. Mm-hmm. And you know, naturally, it's a big market. It's only UK. It's a, you know, health funding products is about £6 billion market. Insurance and trusts are £4.8 billion, at least in 2017. And you know, if you expand beyond the walls of the UK, this market gets much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows health is a, you know, we're living longer. Everyone's carrying more comorbidities now. The governments around the world are unable to sustain the cost of caring for the increasing demand. Mm-hmm. So almost for me, the fundamentals, the macros are right to go into this sort of market and try and do some damage.
Yeah, makes sense. I like the end line there, so do some damage. That's a that's a war cry. But no, I think you're right. I mean, it's anecdotally, I've had private for a long time, and my first experience of drawing on it last year. I won't name the health insurer, but it was staggering. It was one of the big guys. It was so manual. I had to phone up and then had to get it, you know, checked off that it was covered, and then they had to phone me back, and then I had to phone again, and then I had to go. When I turned up to the hospital, I had to sign a form, and I thought, yeah. It turned out to be nothing, but it was quite a serious health scare. And, you know, you've got this stressful time that you're medically you're going through, and then you've got this really stressful process. And it just felt so antiquated. And you thought, when you're talking about medicine, you want medicine to be at the cutting edge, particularly if you're talking about private. And the experience doesn't match that, you know. It's a bit like trying to sort of build a new brand. If a new brand doesn't have the latest tech, and they're pitching themselves that way, you feel a bit disinclined to kind of believe them. So so that's why you made that leap. So you decided to back Healthy. How did you go about it? Did you go for investment? Did you bootstrap? What was your strategy there?
So we're currently fully bootstrapped. And I guess we're lucky enough to be able to make progress without having to raise significant funds. And we can, you know, fund our family lives and all that kind of stuff at the moment. Mm-hmm. The intent is to get to a build of a platform, which we've started, and complete that ready for market launch and coincide that with raise of investment. Uh-huh. So that we can take the business out and actually operate.
Yeah. I mean, I know you and I have discussed this, but I do think there's an optimal time to kind of go for investment. And I see a lot of businesses that come out with a huge amount of investment straight off, and I think you're already having your idea compromised or dictated to you. Do you think there's a sort of, you can get investment too early, can you get too much? What's your kind of plan for what sort of investment you want?
I think it's unique to individuals and the type of businesses that they're starting up. Mm-hmm. If I was trying to sell a widget on a website, then I could probably just get on and do that and try and get some traction. Yeah. And move forward. I think bootstrapping an insurtech is tough because, as you know, it's obviously a regulated market, so you can't launch products without an underwriter and the appropriate like regulatory authorizations and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to be able to get to that point, you need a product defined, you need a platform built, it can't be flaky, you know, you can't have data breaches with it when you go to market, etc. And so there's quite a significant amount of upfront investment. So, you know, testament to any insurtech founder that is able to bootstrap, I mean, it's tough work because you can't really demonstrate anything early. Yeah. in terms of customer traction and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Particularly if you've got a consumer product or an SME product. Mm-hmm. For us, I think the right time is as we get into market because we're not going to be able to operate the company without funding. That's a simple point. But investment in the platforms and systems and all the upfront work to get to that point, we can do because largely it's people. And depending on how you're working to build the platform, if it's people that are you've invited into the team and given away equity, then it's sweat equity and it's great. Mm-hmm. If you have to go out, obviously, you know, to build a cross-platform product these days, I think to a certain level of robustness, you need between 100 and 150,000, in my view, whatever it is. So, you know, as long as we can fund that level, and if people can fund that level of money, then they should just go ahead and try and do it without bootstrapping, but without raising money. Sorry. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, raising money from venture capital is extremely time consuming because, you know, you've got to speak to a lot of people. You've got to screen the venture capitalists pretty well because you want people who get health and insurance rather than people that you need to teach. Mm. Almost educate them on, you know, what the opportunity looks like, and that might seem arrogant, but just I think it takes so much time, and it's distraction away from, you know, basically getting product sorted and built. which I think, you know, is time consuming enough as it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my thing, is that I just worry about the ecosystem we live in, that there's this kind of, and hopefully it's kind of less of it going forward, but there's always been this merry-go-round of people kind of just pitching business plans and going for VC money, and the model is to get more investment and keep the valuation growing. And we're seeing some of those models come to market, even coming to IPO, and it's just not profitable. You know, it's just an investment vehicle. And look, I'm sure a lot of these long-term plays will come off, and you know, Amazon famously didn't make money for something like 20 years. So, and they're doing all right. But I think it speaks to me that I think if an idea is tangible, and you've got a product that can be sold, the longer you can hold out before getting that investment and getting the right investment, it seems to be a good play.
Yeah, I agree.
So what's the kind of vision for the company? Is it going to be a UK focused product? Is it going to be an international offering? Or
so our initial view is to launch it in the UK. Mm-hmm. We know the market in the UK well, and I think there is definitely an opportunity to kind of bring something fresh and new to the market, which is different to what Vitality, Buprioractor and the other incumbents are currently offering. Mm. The intent has always been to internationalize thereafter, because the market here is not big enough. And if we're building a technology platform that's leverageable in other markets, then we want to do that. Not every health economy is going to suit what we're building, but, you know, Central and Eastern Europe and kind of places like India are really interesting economies to go take the type of product that we're building out to market. And obviously, you know, the market sizes there start to get bigger as you get larger population cohorts, even though the you know, GWP per individual life may be lower.
Mm-hmm. And what's the so what is that? We've talked around it, but I don't know if we've explained exactly how does Healthy work? How is it different from the kind of incumbents today?
Yeah, so I think right from the start, our ambition is to build a data and technology company. That's what we are. Yeah. And effectively, intelligently apply that data and technology to manage risk. And in this case, health risk, right? Mm. For people, because we're building a health insurance product, and I guess there are a number of things to our product. So firstly, it's a simpler, cleaner digital product with easier to understand T's and C's. Mm-hmm. You can buy our product in our current journey and the way we rate it in under a minute. We only really need to ask you two questions. And then any additional data that we need, we take almost invisibly, or will take invisibly through the customer, obviously with their permission, when it comes to medical data, mm-hmm. As you onboard and as you start to operate the product. We've got a number of other elements. So many other kind of insurers basically have an authorization process, and then a process which allows, you know, requires the provider to bill the insurer, and, you know, all these additional contrived processes. Our current model is to allow customers to go and get the care that they need, and then effectively we'll reimburse them. Mm-hmm. Although we are looking at a mobile wallet solution, which means we can prepay and pre-populate a card that a customer can use, so they don't have to pay. Right.
Wow. Okay.
Two other interesting areas for us. So it's important to have a directory of providers, and I'll call it a directory recently, but more an intelligent master sourced directory of providers, mm-hmm. where we digitally integrate with them so that we can provide a new or next generation level of customer experience, whether it's booking, ability to pass data to them or take data from their system about what's happening to the customer out, which current insurers haven't really done, in my view. Mm-hmm. And even though the data or some data gets exchanged, it's very manual and makes the it's not very efficient for the provider to do, and increases their administrative burden. And then the final thing is we're building this thing called Doogie Howser, if you're familiar with the medic brain that was Doogie Howser. But effectively a continuously updating graph database which maps the complex relationships between healthcare providers, hospitals, doctors, patients, and all the rich metadata that's associated with it. So as you can imagine, you know, if in an area the NHS is not doing well and there's increasing waiting times for certain treatments, then we might see, one, more demand for private healthcare. And if we've already got customers in the area, then we might see more claims. Mm-hmm. And all of these things, I think, all of these data points should feed into this engine that's Doogie Howser, which allows us to price better, which allows us to manage kind of risk better and serve the customer better. And so we're creating this engine as part of our product team.
Fantastic. So it seems like everything's just, and this one thing I sort of, it's the compounding interest effect of just all these different efficiencies, just being more efficient in every area, providing a better customer service, and the opportunity is obvious in terms of the upside. So I'm really conscious of your time. It's very kind of you to spend some time with me, but one thing I wanted to ask you beforehand, I know you're involved in the accelerator Colour in Tech. Wanted to talk to you briefly about accelerators, because that's come up before, that they're quite a sort of time consuming process, but obviously this is one that you're involved with. So I wanted to find out a little bit about your journey there and why this one works for you.
Yeah, so just generally on accelerators, as you say, I think it's really important to screen the different accelerators and the terms and time commitments, etc., that are required for each of them, and what is there a good fit between what you want to get out of them as a company versus what they can provide? Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. Otherwise, you do end up wasting time and not getting the most out of an accelerator experience. Colour in Tech, really interesting accelerator, which is all to do with supporting people, entrepreneurs from underrepresented backgrounds, effectively. And its, you know, ethos is to help BAME, if I can use that term, or equivalent kind of entrepreneurs, basically provide them with a platform to accelerate their startup and provide them with wraparound services. Mm-hmm. It's very esteemed because it's backed by the likes of Microsoft for Startups, Google, Facebook, and Anthemis and other venture capital funds. So you get access to quite a lot of expertise and mentorship from these companies, whether it's around fundraising, how to get digital marketing for your product going, or just connectivity into a network, which kind of is organic, live, breathing, exciting, and sort of works in your sphere of startup land. And, you know, what Ashley and others are doing at Colour and Tech is really admirable. And I joined really because I'm a real kind of proponent of diversity and inclusion. And it was a really good fit for me in terms of providing a platform to kind of get healthy known, but also to access some of the companies and mentorship and expertise that's available from those companies like Facebook in a really easy and productive way without having to go through my own separate channels. It's a non-equity taking accelerator, and, you know, obviously Healthy is involved in their marketing material. We have a post kind of accelerator relationship with them, and they're very keen to nurture the companies that have been through their pre-accelerator to effectively support their growth, right? And to promote, you know, all the things that diversity and inclusion has to offer.
Fantastic. Sounds like a good program to be on. How long does it run for? How long do you have to be?
So I was in a cohort that started in February, I think, and it ran for 8 to 12 weeks. Yeah. And then we periodically catch up. And in fact, September, we're due to have our kind of catch-up meal if kind of the current COVID situation allows us to do that. Yeah. But there were about... it could be a virtual Zoom meal. 15 or 20 odd people were on the program, and some really interesting startups from kind of the likes of us to people working in financial services and helping small businesses with finance, all sorts of things.
Great. Well, that's fantastic. Like, I won't take up any more of your time. It's been really kind of you to talk to you. When's the go live date? Do we have a set date yet? Or
we've just started development. We think it's going to take us 6 to 8 months. So with Godspeed, hopefully early Q2 is our launch date.
Fantastic. Well, look, fingers crossed for you. Really kind of you to spend some time with me today, and really look forward to seeing what you get up to next year.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Alex.
Thanks, Emmett.
Appreciate it. Cheers.
There you go, guys. That was Emmett Patel. Fascinating guy, as I said. Really good journey. And thanks once again for listening, and keep an eye out for more Lip podcasts in the future. Thank you.